Welcome to Pulmonary Emergencies. My name is David Woodruff. This is the first of a six-part series looking at common emergencies that you may have to face in your patients and how to better manage them. We're going to start out today by talking about pulmonary emergencies and how we can provide better care for these patients. You're going to find that each one of the sections in this emergency series has three major topic areas, and that is prevention, presentation, and then prompt action. The section on prevention is designed to give you some information that you can use in your practice so that you can better try to prevent these patients from developing these kind of a problem in the first place. Secondly, we have the presentation part, and we're going to stick to some things about the presentation that really make it kind of unique. You'll notice at the end of each of these emergency series programs that there is a comparison chart, and at the end of this program there is one that compares these pulmonary emergency problems and what kind of symptoms, as far as chest pain goes, what the oxygenation CO2 would look like, what the patient's breath sounds would be like, and then signs of doom. In other words, what would happen if the patient were to decompensate rapidly, what we could expect. Okay, well, let's get started here talking about pulmonary emergencies. First of all, to understand how important it is to maintain a good functioning pulmonary system in our patient, we need to understand this ventilation perfusion train concept, and that's what's shown on page 1 in your handout. The ventilation perfusion train idea is just kind of a visual way of being able to keep track of all of the components involved in oxygen delivery and oxygen consumption. So if we start out on the left-hand side of the diagram, we have station A over there, and we're trying to move people over to station B. Now, we have chosen as a vehicle here to use a locomotive. So first of all, we have the cars on the train that are going to transport the people over to station B. Of course, they're not going to go anywhere without a locomotive, so we have to have the locomotive. Finally, we get all these people over to station B, and we find out that we didn't bring enough. So that's the concept behind the ventilation perfusion train. Station A on the left-hand side is the lungs. In order to get oxygen to the patient's tissues, we have to first get it into the lungs and get it across that alveolar capillary membrane. And that's what's written down toward the bottom of page 1 here. Lung ventilation and perfusion, very important. We've got to get the oxygen to the alveoli, which means we must have good pulmonary hygiene so that we can get it there in the first place. Secondly, we've got to get it across the interstitial space, and we're going to see how that works, especially with our patient with ARDS. And then thirdly, we have to get it into the capillary network so it can get to the tissues. Once it gets into the bloodstream, then it is PO2. After it becomes PO2, in other words, dissolved oxygen in the blood, it then has to bind to hemoglobin, and we call that oxyhemoglobin. In order to maintain as much oxygen bound to hemoglobin as possible, we have to normalize the patient's pH and body temperature. So some of the things we're going to look for in our patient is to make sure that he's not acidotic or alkalotic, and also to make sure he is not hypothermic and he doesn't have a fever, so that we can get that PO2 bound to hemoglobin, because that's what the tissues use. Now, the next step on our ventilation perfusion train is the hemoglobin itself. We want to try and maximize our patient's available hemoglobin. The best way to do this is preserve his own hemoglobin, because if we give him somebody else's hemoglobin, it starts an inflammatory response in his body that can cause additional complications. The third step in the process is the cardiac output. We want to maximize the patient's cardiac output so that we're getting those cars in the train, the hemoglobin, to the tissues of the body. This is the part that we tend to overdo. In other words, if we're not keeping his lungs clean, and this guy has diminished breath sounds in the bases, or he's got a whole bunch of junk in his lungs and all that other kind of stuff, we're going to end up by giving this patient fluid, giving this patient pressors, doing things with his hemodynamics in order to be able to get enough oxygen to the tissues. If we keep station A optimized, we won't have to overdo, or in other words, we won't have to use as much things to maintain cardiac output. Okay, lastly, we get all that oxygen over there to station B, and we didn't bring enough. So one of the problems that we have is that the tissue oxygen consumption is very high. Now, there's two things that you can do at the patient's bedside to try and decrease tissue oxygen consumption. Decrease the patient's activity level and decrease his body temperature. Now, we're particularly concerned about decreasing fever. We don't want him to be hypothermic. If the patient becomes hypothermic, he will shiver, and that will increase his oxygen consumption. So there is the premise behind the ventilation perfusion train. We're going to try and optimize this with all of our patients who have pulmonary emergencies. Okay, so onward to our first emergency. Flip over to page 2 in your handout. I want to talk a little bit about pulmonary emboli. A pulmonary embolism is a blood clot that gets into the pulmonary vasculature. Now, there's a couple things to keep in mind about this process. This is a blood clot that typically comes from the legs. Now, many of us were taught that this blood clot is coming from the calf, and that isn't entirely true. Most blood clots that cause a pulmonary embolism come from the thighs and the pelvic area, okay, much higher up. The clots that are in the calf don't mobilize very often. So if we're looking for a pulmonary embolism, we need to be looking in the thighs and the pelvic area. So what does the calf have to do with all this? Because don't we put on those SCDs or the PAS or whatever you want to call them, the sequential calf squeezers? Don't we put those on the calf? That's true. Now what happens is, by squeezing the calf is going to help to push blood back up toward the heart, helps to decrease venous stasis. In addition, it also helps release enzymes that will help to prevent clots from occurring in the thighs and the pelvic area. So it does help with where the clots really are. Now once this clot is mobilized, it goes up to the heart. The right side of the heart pumps it into the pulmonary artery. Now the pulmonary vasculature coming from the right side of the heart is going to the lung to become oxygenated. So it is not providing oxygen to the lung. Therefore, the type of symptoms we see with a pulmonary embolus are different than the type of symptoms you see with other kinds of emboli. We don't get ischemia, injury, and necrosis. Instead, what happens is we get a ventilation perfusion mismatch. All right, now that may sound kind of cumbersome. What is a ventilation perfusion mismatch? A ventilation perfusion mismatch occurs when we have ventilation occurring to the lung, but no perfusion. Now, from your assessment standpoint, this is what it looks like. You listen to the patient's lungs and you hear normal breath sounds. That's because we continue to have ventilation. However, the perfusion has been blocked by the embolism. See the diagram on page 2. Perfusion has been blocked. That means we have an alveolus that is filled up with air, but it is not being perfused. The vascular supply is not being perfused. So it's kind of like having this big blown-up balloon, and there's no vascular supply around it because of that embolism. Now, normally there is a balance kept between the amount of pressure in the alveolus and the amount of pressure in the pulmonary capillary. When the pulmonary capillary no longer has pressure in it because of this embolism, that's going to lead to this ventilation perfusion mismatch, and that leads to the development of inflammation. The development of inflammation eventually is going to lead to fluid accumulation, and we will hear that as rouse on our assessment. Okay, now, but keep in mind, your patient hits the call light, he's complaining of chest pain, you run into his room, he's having a PE. Now, if you listen to his lungs right now, you're not going to hear any changes in breath sounds. Ventilation is maintained. This afternoon or tonight, you'll probably hear some changes due to those rouse. Okay, so here's how we prevent it. We need to compress the calf. Now, you see, when you're at work and you're running up and down the hall all day long, you don't develop a PE. And that's because you're compressing your calf, squeezing the calf by walking. So our patient either needs to ambulate, he needs to walk, or we need to compress his calf for him. We do that with the SCDs or the PAS. Those are those sequential air-filled things that we put on a patient's calf. We can also do that with our venous thromboembolism prophylaxis. This is the sub-Q heparin or the low molecular weight heparins like Lovenox. It's going to help to prevent him from developing the clot in the first place. Now, in presentation, we want to be looking for a few things. First of all, we want to look for Virchow's triad of risk factors. Virchow's triad of risk factors are three identifiable risk factors that puts our patient at risk for developing that PE. They are venous stasis. Is your patient ambulating and squeezing his calf? Endothelial injury. Endothelial injury refers to an injury to the lining of the blood vessel. This happens during surgery, this happens during trauma, and this happens during sepsis. Lastly, alteration in coagulation. Now, this happens again after surgery, after trauma, but also during sepsis. Now, that brings up another patient population that we don't normally think as being prone to developing a PE, and that is your septic patient. So we're going to have to think about the possibility of a PE in that septic patient, too, because he probably has Virchow's triad of risk factors. Now, the signs and symptoms of a pulmonary embolism. Many of us may have been taught your patient's going to be anxious and restless and apprehensive and hypoxic. He'll have a red swollen calf. All of these kind of things. Those, although we may have been taught that those were classic signs and symptoms of PE, in the 1990s they did a study called the PIOPED study. And in the PIOPED study they found that the most common signs and symptoms of a pulmonary embolism are tachycardia. Any patient who has an unexplained tachycardia, we should rule out pulmonary embolism. The second most common one was rales. Now keep in mind, rales develop over time. So if the patient just right now starts complaining of chest pain, he may not have those rales yet. Most common symptoms were dyspnea, pleuritic chest pain. Pleuritic chest pain is sharp, localized, and worse on inspiration. And cough. The cough is coming from the ventilation perfusion mismatch. Okay, so there we have the signs and symptoms we're looking for. Now, that tachycardia may be kind of subtle. I was talking to a nurse a couple months ago, and we had talked about pulmonary emboli. She went back to work, and she said, you know, my patient's got a tachycardia this morning, and I can't explain it. He's not dry. I looked at his INO. His INO is okay. I can't figure out any reason why this patient would have a tachycardia. She looked back, and she said, you know, he's got Virchow's triad of risk factors. So she called the doctor and she said, you know, the patient's got Virchow's triad of risk factors and he has this new onset of tachycardia that I can't explain. Now, the patient had no other symptoms. He didn't have chest pain. He didn't have any of these other symptoms. But the doctor said, you know, I think you're right. We better get a VQ scan just to be sure. They got a VQ scan and sure enough, the patient had a pulmonary embolism. Now, you see, by doing that work, they were able to then prophylactically treat the patient so he didn't get another one. Good catch. All right, now, diagnostically, there's a few things we can look at, and it's pretty well summed up by taking a look at that little puzzle piece diagram over on the right-hand side on page 2. The first piece of the puzzle is the clinical presentation. Virchow's triad of risk factors and the signs and symptoms from the PIOPED study. Does my patient have these things? Next, we could take a look at a D-dimer. The D-dimer test is a lab test that tells us if the patient is trying to break down clots. Now, D-dimer is going to be elevated regardless of why he's trying to break down a clot. This clot could be from surgery, could be from trauma, could be from sepsis, it could be from a lot of different things. It just tells us that the patient is trying to break down a clot. So the value of doing a D-dimer is not in its positive predictive value. In other words, a positive D-dimer does not rule in a PE. Just the opposite. We do the D-dimer for its negative predictive value. In other words, if the D-dimer is negative, your patient does not have a pulmonary embolism. Okay, next step around there, the venogram. we can take a look at that venous ultrasound. Remember, we're looking in the thighs and the pelvic area. If the venous ultrasound is positive and the patient has a positive clinical correlation for pulmonary embolism, 96% of those patients have a PE. Good evidence there. Okay, we should treat that patient rather than sending him for a VQ scan or a spiral CT. However, what happens a lot of times is we get the muddy picture. We got a patient who maybe has a little bit of Virchow's triad. He's got a couple signs and symptoms from the PyoPET study, and he's got a negative venogram. What do you do then? Then it's time to go for the VQ scan or the spiral CT. The spiral CT only takes about 20 seconds to do the chest. A VQ scan takes hours. So my preference would be, if I have to go down to this test with the patient, I would rather go for this spiral CT. Okay, now what do we do? Prompt action. First is identification. And if you're going to identify the people who have a pulmonary embolism, we need to be looking for the signs and symptoms from the PyoPET study. We need to be looking for Virchow's triad of risk factors. Look for that unexpected and unexplained tachycardia. Oxygenate the patient. Put him on supplemental oxygen. Assess his hemodynamics. Support them if necessary. The thing that makes a pulmonary embolism life-threatening is not hypoxia so much as it is altered hemodynamics. Look at the picture at the top of the page. You see how the right side of the heart has to pump against that thing? That's like having an accident on the freeway. Traffic backs up. Well, blood's going to back up here. And that's going to cause him to have heart failure. So hemodynamics are the most important thing we got to keep our eye on here. If the patient becomes hemodynamically unstable, anticipate that they may treat him with thrombolytics, TPA, break down the clot. Our second problem is acute respiratory distress syndrome. We also call this ARDS. In trying to prevent your patient from developing ARDS, it's helpful to know what the risk factors are. There really is no way to prevent it. If the patient develops one of these risk factors, there is a chance that he can develop ARDS, and there's really nothing we can do. We can't stop the process. However, we can be aware of what the risk factors are, so we can be looking for ARDS in the early stages, and hopefully we can get our patient more prompt treatment so he doesn't develop additional complications. Take a look in your handout on page 3. You'll notice that there's a list there at the top, and it says, look for the risk factors, and that's the things we're going to be looking for. Notice that sepsis is the number one risk factor for ARDS. So obviously, your patient who's septic, that's going to be the guy you want to look for, the possibility of him developing ARDS. Take a look at that list and see how many of these patients you care for on a regular basis. Maybe you care for more than, a patient that has more than one of these things at a time. There's an additive risk if a patient has more than one of these risk factors. In other words, if your patient has two of these risk factors, his chance of developing ARDS almost doubles. Three, he's got an 85% chance of developing ARDS. So how do we know? Well, here's the presentation, a little bit different than you may be thinking. What's listed underneath the presentation in your handout is what happens in the alveolar flooding stage. So let me describe what's happening in the three pictures in the middle of page 3. The first picture on the left describes the latent phase. So ARDS goes through phases before we actually see this refractory hypoxemia, the whiteout in the chest x-ray, and all that stuff that we normally associate with ARDS. The first phase is called the latent phase. And in the latent phase, there really isn't anything going on except we have some changes in that alveolar capillary membrane. So your patient is not going to, at this point in time, he's not going to complain of hypoxia. He's not going to have the whiteout on the chest x-ray. We're going to have to be looking for more subtle signs that he is developing ARDS. In the latent phase, the only sign we may see is a decrease in the patient's PO2-FiO2 ratio. To figure out the PO2-FiO2 ratio, so you simply just take the patient's PO2, let's say it's 100, divide it by the patient's FiO2, in other words, how much oxygen he is on. If he's on room air, that's 0.21. Let's say our patient, though, is on a 50% Venti mask. If you divide his PO2, and we gave him a PO2 of 100, if you divide 100 by 0.5, you'll end up with a PO2-FiO2 ratio of 200. A normal PO2-FiO2 ratio is greater than 300. So at 200, our patient would be considerably low, and we would want to do something about that. Now, we don't usually know. That's the problem. If we have the opportunity, say, for example, you work in an intensive care unit, and your patient is going to be transferred out to the floor today, and we happen to take a blood gas on him before he goes, you see, that's the time you might catch it. If you work on a regular floor, you may not know this, because you don't see any outward signs of a low PO2-FiO2 ratio. Then what happens is the patient moves into the interstitial edema phase. And in the interstitial edema phase, now this patient is starting to develop some symptoms. He's going to have a subjective dyspnea with an increase in respiratory rate. This signals the interstitial edema phase. Now what happens in the interstitial edema phase is this patient is starting to develop pulmonary edema. Now, this kind of pulmonary edema is a little bit different than the type we're probably more used to. We're probably a little bit more used to dealing with patients who have cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Now, cardiogenic pulmonary edema, the patient has fluid leaking out of the lung because there's too much back pressure. So the heart isn't pumping well, it's backing up into the lung, and that's what's causing this back pressure, causing the edema formation. However, in a patient who has ARDS, the edema is being formed because he has capillary permeability. So now fluid is leaking out of the capillaries and going into the interstitial space in the lung. You can't see this on the chest x-ray, and if you listen to his lungs, you won't hear it until the fluid moves into the alveolus. However, what we will see is the patient starts to have decreased compliance in his lungs, and the symptoms he will exhibit will be an increase in respiratory rate that's associated with subjective dyspnea. So at this point in time, in the interstitial edema phase, now the patient's got something we can kind of put our finger on. But think about the presentation. When a patient has an increase in respiratory rate with subjective dyspnea, think about how that presents. He hits the call light, you go down to his room, and the patient says, "You know, I feel like I can't catch my breath." So you listen to his lungs. His lungs are clear. Notice the picture. There's no fluid in the alveoli yet. You listen, or you put on his pulse ox, and you check his pulse ox. His pulse ox is okay, at maybe 98%. See, the fluid isn't in the alveolus yet. It's still, we're getting oxygen across that membrane. But he's feeling that fluid in that interstitial space. So now what do? You call the doctor up and you say, "Well, his lungs are clear, his pulse ox is okay, but he's complaining of having trouble breathing." What do you think the doctor's going to tell you? He's probably going to say, "Just keep monitoring the patient." So how do we do that? If the doctor says, "Well, keep monitoring the patient," or we think we're in this interstitial edema phase, a lot of times what happens is we start to doubt ourselves. So now we're saying that this patient is just plain anxious, don't we? He hit the call line. He's complaining of difficulty breathing. Don't we think this guy's just anxious? Then we get down the anxiety route. So when we call the doctor up, we say, "You know, Mr. Jones is anxious, and we need something here for anxiety." We give him that something for anxiety. Now he's asleep, so he can't complain. He can't tell us he's getting worse. And then suddenly, a little bit later, we find he's hypoxic, and he's in respiratory distress, and we have to intubate him and send him to the ICU. So when you have a patient who's in the interstitial edema phase, or a patient who you think is developing a respiratory distress and he's exhibiting those subtle signs, increase in respiratory rate associated with subjective dyspnea, rather than blowing it off or thinking, "Well, no, that can't be," consider it this way. Think, well, maybe fluid is moving into that interstitial space. If it is, the next step in the process will be to flood the alveolus. So how do you know? We can do a focused assessment listening to the bases in the back, and we're going to be able to hear when the alveoli start flooding. Okay, so that's how we're going to tell if he's moving in that direction. When should we expect that maybe he's got interstitial edema? Well, take a look at the top of the page. Those patients who have the risk factors. Your patient doesn't have the risk factors, we don't really have to assume he's in the interstitial edema phase of ARDS. But if your patient has a risk factor, now he's complaining of subjective dyspnea with an increase in respiratory rate, until we can prove otherwise, we probably better assume he's in the interstitial edema phase. Now, there's nothing you can do to stop the process, but being aware that he's there, we can more closely monitor him. So hopefully he never gets to be hypoxic. He may still need to be intubated, but hopefully we're staying on top of it this way. Now, the third phase is the alveolar flooding phase, and that's the presentation that's listed in the handout. When we've got the profound hypoxemia that is refractory to oxygen therapy, the whiteout on the chest x-ray, this guy is a mess, and he needs to be intubated and ventilated at this point. But you see, there's a progression, and we may have some warning signs ahead of time, so we're not surprised by it. So what is our actions? The number one, first, most important thing we got to do is we have to stop the process. We stop the process by turning off the risk factor. If your patient's got shock, let's treat the shock. If your patient has sepsis, let's treat the sepsis. If he's got pancreatitis, let's try and stop the inflammation. But we turn off the risk factor. Watch your fluid resuscitation. This guy may be pretty unstable right now, and we're giving him some fluids. If you give him a lot of fluids now, what can happen? Take a look at those pictures. We're going to flood the alveolus. We don't want to give him more ammunition there for flooding the alveolus. Watch your fluid volumes that you put into this kind of guy. Doesn't mean we don't give him any. Just be aware. Block the mechanism of the alveolar capillary membrane injury. We've tried that for years. That means using steroids and things like that. It doesn't work. That doesn't work. Maximize his oxygen delivery by using the ventilation perfusion train. Consider alternatives to mechanical ventilation. Maybe this patient will need some other kind of ventilation, high-frequency ventilation. Maybe he needs nitric oxide, all those fancy kind of things. We have to do those over in the ICU. But maybe he needs something other than just traditional ventilation. Limit his complications by doing really good pulmonary hygiene. He needs great pulmonary hygiene. This fluid is leaking into his alveoli, and we can't get it back out because it's inflammatory fluid. This is not just like cardiogenic pulmonary edema. That's serous fluid. You give him some Lasix, you suck it right back out. This is inflammatory fluid, and we're not going to be able to get it back out once it gets there. So let's keep it moving with good pulmonary hygiene. Okay, flip over to page 4 in your handout, and let's talk a little bit about pulmonary edema. Now, we're going to differentiate pulmonary edema here just a little bit, because there's different ways that pulmonary edema can form. And I think you've probably already gotten this idea somewhat from the previous discussion about ARDS. The first way that our patient can develop pulmonary edema is by hydrostatic pressure. This is what happens when your patient has cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Basically, there's just too much fluid on board. So when there's too much fluid on board, it just leaks out of the pulmonary capillaries and it leaks into the patient's alveolus. Okay, notice the picture on the right. This picture is showing an alveolus and a pulmonary capillary. Now, I described before this process of finding a PO2-FiO2 ratio. Can you see the two components there? FiO2, fraction of inspired oxygen, is what the patient is inhaling. It gets into the alveolus. What is in the capillary there, the PO2, is the oxygen that is dissolved in the blood. Now, simply the process is FiO2 crosses that membrane and dissolves in the blood first as PO2. So that's why we look at that relationship rather than looking at FiO2 versus the oxygen saturation. There's other factors that come into play there. So with the PO2F to ratio, you can see from this diagram, hopefully a little bit more clearly, as to what it is we're looking at. All right, now back to our pulmonary edema. In the first example of hydrostatic pulmonary edema, what happens is there's too much pressure. Now, envision in that capillary, too much pressure, too much fluid in there, and it's going to try and escape. And it does so. It just pushes out through the little pulmonary capillary junctions there where the capillary kind of pulls together. And the fluid leaks out into the interstitial space. And eventually, just like in ARDS, it fills the interstitial space first, and then it starts flooding the alveolus. And that's when we say our patient's got pulmonary edema, is when that alveolus is flooded. So at that point in time, you're also going to hear the RALS, you're going to see the evidence on the chest x-ray, hypoxemia, all that kind of junk. But before that, like in ARDS, this patient will go through that interstitial phase. And in that interstitial phase, you're again going to see an increase in respiratory rate associated with subjective dyspnea. Now, in this case here, we have kind of a reason why. In other words, this is a little bit easier to pinpoint. If your patient's got the cardiac history, you can go back and look at his fluid volume status. Okay, so simply we look at the patient's INO, his intake and output. Has he had more intake than output? Then we look at the patient's weight. Keep in mind, our patients in the hospital don't gain weight because of our good food. It's going to be because of water. So we look at the INO, we look at the weight, we can look at the patient's jugular veins. If we see jugular venous distension, and the patient's INO is positive, and his weight has gone up, certainly this patient is volume overloaded. Now we're hearing him complain of that subjective dyspnea with an increase in respiratory rate. Remember the anxiety guy? And now we would say, look, he's volume overloaded. I think he's in an interstitial edema phase of pulmonary edema. Now if we give him the diuretics and get rid of that fluid, he won't flood the alveolus. He won't become hypoxic. He won't have to be intubated or ventilated or all that kind of stuff. We avoid the problem. So that one's pretty easy to fix. He's got too much fluid on board. You give him some Lasix. You pull it off. Not a big deal. Now, we want to keep him away from that, though, so don't get the false impression that I want you overloading your patients and then we're going to try and pull it off. No, we want to keep him from becoming fluid overloaded in the first place. Now, the second type of pulmonary edema is caused by osmotic pressure. This happens when a patient has a problem like hyponatremia or hypoalbuminemia. There isn't enough pull in the vasculature to keep the fluid in there. Now, one of the mechanisms that controls how much fluid stays in the vasculature and how much gets out into the tissues is this concept of osmotic pressure. Now, osmotic pressure really is, I know it sounds kind of confusing and, you know, something real technical and laboratory-like, but it really isn't that big a deal. Osmotic pressure just refers to how many particles we have on each side of the membrane. Okay, now if you envision the membrane as being that pulmonary capillary, and the membrane around that capillary, if there's a bunch of particles outside in that interstitial space, but there's not a whole lot of particles inside the capillary, fluid always moves to where there's more particles. Now the particles we're concerned about is sodium, albumin, glucose, and BUN. Those things control fluid movement in the body. So obviously a patient who has a low sodium, he doesn't have enough particles in the bloodstream. That means there's more particles out in the tissues. Fluid moves out of the bloodstream into the tissues. So in a low sodium state, fluid is going to move out of the vasculature and into the interstitial space. Now, eventually, just like any other kind of pulmonary edema, it's going to fill that interstitial space. There's going to be so much pressure in the interstitial space that it pushes fluid into the alveolus. Same deal with hypoalbuminemia. Okay, let's take a look at the capillary permeability issue. This happens primarily during sepsis, and the end result of that is going to be ARDS. Okay, remember the connection from the previous section? Sepsis is the most common risk factor, leads to ARDS. It leads to that capillary permeability that occurs in the lung, and that's going to cause pulmonary edema, and by the same way we saw before, in the interstitial space first, then into the alveolus. Okay, so what do we see on presentation? If this is caused by hydrostatic pressure, in other words, if this is volume overload, we're going to see a positive intake versus our output. We're going to see an increase in the patient's weight, and we're going to see jugular venous distension. Okay, for more information about how to measure jugular venous distension, you might want to check out our cardiovascular assessment program. However, just very briefly here, you sit the patient up 30 degrees, head of the bed up 30 degrees, and you look at the jugular veins. Normally, you'll see the jugular veins, maybe about 3 or 4 centimeters, that's just about a little over an inch, above the patient's clavicle. If you're seeing those jugular veins into the mid part of the neck or even all the way up in the neck, that means the patient's volume overloaded. Correlate that with the weight and with the INO and you've got some pretty good information. Okay, now we look for that subjective dyspnea with an increase in respiratory rate. We're going to see that first. Remember, that happens when the fluid moves into the interstitial space. Lastly, we would see the rouse. Okay, that's when the fluid has moved into the alveolus. We don't want to wait for that if we can. After all that has happened, then the patient becomes hypoxic. Now there's so much back pressure on the heart that we get the hemodynamic collapse. Kind of from a combination of not having enough oxygen to the heart and the heart's just not beating very well, and so it backs up. Okay, so what is our prompt action? We need to get that fluid out of the lung. Now, a quick way to do this, regardless of what type it is, capillary permeability, osmotic pressure, or hydrostatic pressure, you intubate the patient and ventilate him. Another option would be you could put the patient on BiPAP. BiPAP is also called non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, and it's going to do the same kind of thing. You see, what we're trying to do here is to get some positive pressure in that alveolus and push that fluid back out. And that can happen with our positive pressure ventilation. We need to manage the patient's preload. Now, obviously, if this is hydrostatic pressure, in other words, CHF, that makes sense. Well, we've got to get rid of some of that fluid, right? But with any of them, if the patient's got osmotic pressure, the patient has capillary permeability, and that's what's causing his pulmonary edema, we still have to be careful about his fluid volume status. Because if he gets too much, hey, guess where it's going to go? So we have to be careful of that. Now, there's a few ways we can manage fluid volume. We can get rid of it with diuretics. We can try and increase the patient's renal blood flow so that he's going to diurese it out. Or we can decrease the venous capacitance by giving a medication like nitroglycerin. Nitroglycerin is going to help cause venous vasodilation and keep the fluid out there away from the heart. We can improve the patient's cardiac output. First of all, if we're going to do this, we have to always plug in the pump first. Okay, again, now if you want more information about hemodynamics, check out our program, Understand Hemodynamics Today, or Mending the Broken Heart. Those are both good programs for understanding how to deal with hemodynamics. But we need to plug in the pump first. That means we get more oxygen to the heart before we tell it to work harder. Lastly, afterload is the resistance the heart has to pump against. We don't usually deal with this directly because it's being caused by the sympathetic nervous system, which is being activated by the low cardiac output state. So if we focus more on the preload reduction and increasing the patient's cardiac output, then this gets just a little bit easier. So again, here's our goal. Watch for the interstitial edema phase. That's the subjective dyspnea with the increase in respiratory rate. Watch his fluids. We have to be careful with his fluids. Okay, on to problem number 4, and that is a pneumothorax. Now, in our hospitalized patients, pneumothorax is a possibility, mostly from iatrogenic type of causes. These include things like our positive pressure, mechanical ventilation, and central line insertions. So those should be obviously some times when we might see it. Okay, so let's take a look at those. Positive pressure ventilation not only includes intubating the patient and putting them on a ventilator, but even our patient who is on non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. Okay, so we're on your handout, page number 5 there. At the top it says NIPPV. That stands for non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. That is CPAP and that is BiPAP. Pushing air into this patient's lungs can cause the patient to develop a pneumothorax. And that's not just in the matter of the fact that we've got pressure going in. But whenever a patient is on positive pressure ventilation, it changes the way that air flows in the lungs so that that airflow doesn't go the way it normally would. And that can be a problem. So that's what happens here, is that we have a change in the way that the airflow is going in the lungs, and that is possibly causing the patient to have too much pressure in some parts of the lung and not enough in other parts. And that's what can lead to the patient developing a pneumothorax. So even if your patient's on BiPAP. Now, you know your guy who's on BiPAP for sleep apnea? You probably don't need to be as worried about this with him. For one, he's used to it. He uses this thing all the time. But how about your guy who maybe is on your floor or in your unit and he's had some difficulty breathing with his COPD, so we put him on CPAP or we put him on BiPAP? We'd have to be more worried about that guy. If your patient is intubated and ventilated on a ventilator, obviously that increases the risk of the patient developing pneumothorax. Now, one of the things we can do, though, is we can watch his airway pressures, try and keep him away from those high airway pressures, and that would help limit the amount of pneumothorax. Using a high volume with our mechanical ventilation leads to a lot of problems with pneumothorax, and they found this out with patients who have ARDS. They put them on a low tidal volume strategy. They call this the lung protective strategy. They were able to decrease the amount of pneumothoraces in patients considerably. In addition, it also considerably decreases the patient's mortality by using a low tidal volume strategy. Something to think about. Okay, now what do we do about that central line? Because we're putting in central lines all over the place, aren't we? Not just in the ICU, but on the floors and everywhere else. They did a study a few years ago, and they took a look at central line insertion. In one hospital, they had a 12% complication rate associated with central line insertion. They found, and this was a teaching hospital, of course, so you know how that goes. You see one, you do one, you teach one, right? Now think about how fast that degrades. If the one you saw was bad, the one you did was worse, and the one you're teaching is even worse than that, how fast does that degrade? Okay, so they put into place a new teaching strategy here, and they were teaching their residents and teaching their fellows and everybody else how to put in central lines with this new teaching strategy. Believe it or not, they were able to get their central line complication rate down to less than 1%. Fantastic. But it really shows the significance of a good teaching program, and why I'm telling you this is, you got somebody in there that's digging around, maybe the house officer on a night shift or something. He's in there digging around, and he's not finding it, and he's not doing too well. We better get somebody else in there to do the job, okay? Because he's going to nick the lung, the patient's going to develop a pneumothorax and have additional complications. Okay, now, not really on a prevention aspect, but after the central line is inserted, we want that chest x-ray. Not so that we can prevent the pneumothorax, but so at least we can have prompt detection. Now, there has been some debate in hospitals about whether or not we should do that chest x-ray after a central line insertion. And my feeling still is that we need that chest x-ray. Okay, so if they put in a central line and they ask me to use it without a chest x-ray, I'm going to ask the doctor for a specific order that says, okay to use central line without chest x-ray. Haven't found a doctor yet that'll do it. So they usually order that chest x-ray. And for no other reason, I just want to make sure it's in the right place. I don't want to contribute to a problem. Okay, now here's what's going on. You see the picture on the right-hand side there on page 5, and it's showing the lung tissue, and then the kind of gray line there around the outside is the chest wall. In between is the pleural space, and the pleural space contains just a tiny little bit of fluid, and it has a negative pressure. In other words, it has a vacuum. Now, this vacuum is what pulls the lung out to the chest wall. Without the vacuum, the lung goes into its normal state, which is just collapsed. It's like a balloon. But instead of blowing it up, I think a lot of us have this impression that we're blowing up the lungs when we take a breath in or something. But what happens is the chest wall moves out, the vacuum or the suction that's in that chest wall pulls the lung with it, and that's what expands the lung and pulls air in. Now, the reason why I give you all that detail is when you look at that picture, isn't it obvious that we're going to have respiratory distress if we lose that suction, if we lose that vacuum? What will happen is the lung will go to its normal state, which is collapsed, and it won't work. So we need to restore that negative pressure. And the way we do it is by putting in a chest tube and hooking it up to chest drainage. So what do we have on presentation? Well, the patient often has hypoxia and dyspnea. One of the things that many of us have been told is to look for decreased breath sounds on the affected side. Now, this may happen, but it may not. Okay, when you go back and look at that picture again, remember that air is going to go up to the top. The pleural space is on the outside. So where the pneumothorax is going to be is in the upper outer aspect. There isn't a whole lot of airflow in the upper outer aspect. So what might happen is you're listening to breath sounds and you hear them on that side because you're hearing air moving in the airways. And the patient actually has a pneumothorax. So another way that we can assess is not only listening for breath sounds on both sides, but also feeling the chest for excursion. Get your hands on there and feel his chest for excursion. And see if you feel less excursion on that side that could potentially have the pneumo. Of course, chest x-ray is really going to give us the most information here. So what is our prompt action? If the pneumo is small, it'll just be observation. If your patient is symptomatic, we may have to put in chest drainage. Usually that's going to be a chest tube. However, sometimes we use a thoracic catheter. That's a very small, thin chest tube, basically, is what it is. We can also do a needle thoracotomy, and that's used for patients who have a tension pneumothorax. Basically, all we're doing is we're sticking a needle into that pleural space, just a needle. I mean, it's wide open. We're turning his tension pneumothorax into an open pneumothorax. A McSwain dart or a McSwain valve is a one-way valve that we can put onto our chest tube or that we can put onto that needle so that it allows air out but does not allow air back in. If your patient has a chest drainage system in place, that's probably not necessary. Now remember, we're going to have good pain control. This guy just developed a pneumothorax, we just stuck a big tube in his chest, and now we're going to expect him to take deep breaths and cough and do all that kind of stuff. The good pulmonary hygiene. Well, guess what, folks? He's not going to do it. Not unless we have good pain control. And then oxygen, very important if the patients become hypoxic. Down at the bottom of the page, just some reminders. We're going to hook up this chest tube to a chest drainage system. So just some reminders here. The components of a properly functioning chest drainage system are: we're going to have gentle bubbling in the suction chamber. That is assuming that you have a water-filled suction chamber. If you have the dry suction chamber that just has a little dial on it, then, of course, we're not going to see any bubbling there. But no bubbling in a water seal. Now, we'll see bubbling through the water seal. Remember, the water seal is the one-way valve. We'll see bubbling in there when you first put the tube in. That's okay. We don't want to continue to see bubbling in the water seal, or it means we have an air leak. Thirdly, gentle rising and falling in a water seal with respiration. That's called titling. That indicates our system is patent. Okay, so again, pneumothorax. Probably going to happen with positive pressure ventilation or central line insertion. We're going to look for the diminished breath sounds on the affected side, also with decreased chest excursion. Anticipate, we got to get in that chest tube. Manages pain, manages oxygenation. Alrighty, flip over to page 6 and let's talk about our fifth problem, and that is pneumonia. Now, I'm specifically going to talk about a hospital-acquired pneumonia. The community-acquired pneumonia, you know, that's what your patient gets at home. He comes into the hospital and he's already sick. He's got the pneumonia. Now, the best thing we can do for that guy with the community-acquired pneumonia is get him his antibiotics. If you get him his antibiotics within the first 4 hours, it actually decreases mortality. Wow. But hospital-acquired pneumonia. This is the deal where the patient came into the hospital for some other problem. Maybe he's there because he had a heart attack. Maybe he's there because he had surgery. And now we give him the pneumonia. That's a iatrogenic or a hospital-acquired. We also call it ventilator-associated pneumonia. So this is something that we gave him in the hospital. He didn't come here with it. All right, now so how does this happen then? First of all, look at the risk factors listed at the top of page 6. Do your patients have any of these things? You're probably saying, oh my gosh, all my patients have one of those things. Maybe some of your patients have 3 or 4 or 5 of those things. In other words, our patients who are in the hospital are going to be at risk for developing pneumonia. Okay, so how else could we prevent it? Well, think about how it gets there. The patient's already at risk. We already identified that. Now, how does that bacteria get to the patient? Well, maybe it's being carried by nurses. Now, for years, I have defended you guys. Okay, I kept standing up to the plate there saying, no, no, no. Nurses wash their hands. We're good at that. It's the other caregivers, right? The doctors. And maybe it's somebody else who's coming into the room. As a matter of fact, we found in one institution that it was a clergy member that was transmitting a bug around the intensive care unit. Wasn't washing his hands between patients. Now, to get back to us nurses. Sorry, guys, but you know there was a study that was done last year by the American Association of Critical Care Nurses, and they looked at neonatal intensive care unit nurses. Now, if there's ever a nurse that should be really vigilant about washing their hands, I would think it would be the neonatal intensive care unit nurse, because they're dealing with patients with no immune system. However, they found that only 48% of patient contacts did the nurse wash their hands. Wow. A little disappointing. I thought we were doing better than that. So maybe just a general reminder right now, hey, hand washing seems to be a big thing because we seem to be getting this stuff spread around. Okay, what else can we do? Mouth care. Mouth care is very important. Now think about the way you do mouth care on your patients. Little swabby deals, right? Those little foam swabs. Okay, if you're not using a toothbrush, let's start. Now, you don't have to get carried away here. You don't have to, you know, get him in and get that toothbrush in there and foam them all up and all that other kind of stuff. You don't have to get carried away. But use the mechanical action of the toothbrush, even if you're just using that little peroxide rinse or whatever that comes with the foamy things. We need the mechanical action of the toothbrush to be able to break that plaque free. Because we think the bacteria is living on the plaque that's on his teeth. Okay, so we need to get rid of that plaque. Good mouth care. Now think about how often you do mouth care too. Suctioning the mouth, we used to do that every time we suctioned the endotracheal tube on patients who were intubated. However, in studies now, they found on average we suction the endotracheal tube about 8 times in 24 hours, and we clean the patient's mouth out, using the Ankar suction and getting the stuff in the back of the throat, 3 times every 24 hours. You see, now it's just part of mouth care. Okay, so mouth care, fine. But if your patient has got a lot of secretions, make sure you're getting them out with that Yankar suction. Don't let them, just kind of sit back there. And especially if your patient's on a ventilator or has a trach, because those cuffs will hold the secretions and they pool there. Now, what happens when those secretions pool is they start to grow bacteria, and then that bacteria slides down around that endotracheal tube or that trach and gets into the lungs. Good mouth care, very, very important. Care of equipment, and I'm only going to talk about one. We found that most equipment, things like ventilator circuits and things like that, should not be changed because if we open the circuit, we're going to cause problems with infection. But there is one piece of equipment that we do need to pay more attention to, and that's the Yankar suction. Your Yankar suction, most nurses, I would say, are either storing it back in the plastic sheath it comes in. Now, I like that because it looks good. You know, it looks like a sterile environment. It looks nice and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But what they've found is that is probably the worst environment because it's anaerobic. And when they cultured Yankar suctions, the ones that were put back in the plastic sheath grew more bacteria than even the ones that they just slid underneath the head of the bed. Isn't that something? Okay, so we don't want to put it back in the plastic sheath. The recommendation is rinse it out and put it on a dry paper towel to dry. Keep the head of the bed up 30 degrees. This was also found in a study done by the American Association of Critical Care Nurses last year that on average, most nurses only had the head of the bed up 15 degrees, despite the fact that they had charted patients' head of the bed up 30 degrees. Okay, so I guess we're overestimating or underestimating, whatever the case may be, but we're not estimating head of the bed as well as we should be. All right, so we've done all those things. Our patient, we think, may be developing pneumonia. How do we know? When you take a look under presentation there, you notice some of the typical signs and symptoms we associate with it. So, you know, fever, okay. Increased respiratory rate. Now, some of the figures here, some of these numbers here, are from the Ebola study where they looked at patients who had pneumonia and whether or not these patients had, you know, what kind of symptoms they developed. So here's what they found. 82% developed an increase in white count. 80% had evidence on their chest x-ray. And 76% needed oxygen therapy. Flip down here for a moment and notice that only 64% had sputum production and abnormal breath sounds. Now, when I ask most nurses, how would you assess a patient for pneumonia? Well, listen to his lungs, is what most people say. Or we'd look for sputum production. Or we'd look for a fever. Maybe an increase in white count, increase in respiratory rate. Okay, notice that the sputum production and abnormal breath sounds, this is one of the first things we're going to be using in our assessment, right? Only happens in 64% of patients. Now, also keep in mind that none of those things, the sputum production, the abnormal breath sounds, the fever, the increase in respiratory rate, the increase in white count, none of those things are early warning signs. See, here's what we're going to do instead. You see the diagram in the middle of the page? It says that if we see a trend upward in respiratory rate, okay, yesterday it's 16, today it's 24. Big deal, right? But that's a trend up. Okay, so we're going to look for an increase in body temperature or an increase in white count. Now remember again, we're looking for trends here. So yesterday's temperature is 98.6 Fahrenheit, 37 degrees centigrade. Today it's 37.5 centigrade or, what is that, 100 degrees Fahrenheit? Not much of a change. We wouldn't even trade it. But if his respiratory rate went up also, you got to think this guy is developing pneumonia. Okay, you see, now you kick up your pulmonary interventions. You do the turning, the positioning, the ambulation. You need to kick up your pulmonary interventions here, and you'll probably be able to prevent that pneumonia from ever catching hold. You know, he'll move that stuff along, and maybe he'll never even get infected. Look for the increase in white count. Yesterday it's 7, today it's 8. Big deal. You know, it's still normal. And if you're scanning your labs, like most of us do, you know, most of us look at labs and we're looking for that H or that L, right? We're looking for that thing that says high or low. Okay, you're not going to see it here. So we're going to have to, this is one of the labs. Now, there's a couple labs you have to look at trends in. One of them is the white count. Another one of them is going to be your hemoglobin and hematocrit. We have to look for trends, not just for absolute lows and highs. So we see a trending up in white count, increase in respiratory rate, same thing. You got to think it's pneumonia. Okay, so what can we do? Again, good pulmonary hygiene. Kick up our pulmonary hygiene. Get that patient moving. The number one, the best thing you can do for your patient's pulmonary hygiene is to move him. It's not natural to lay in bed in the supine position, especially with the head of the bed up 30 degrees. That's going to tend to make all the secretions pool to the bases in the back. Of course, the patient will probably need antibiotics. If the patient has a resistant organism or to try and prevent resistant organisms, many hospitals have gone to antibiotic rotation. Antibiotic rotation takes the antibiotic. They take, you know, different antibiotics like every 3 months. And back in pharmacy, they will pull all your normal formulary off the shelf. They put it back in the storage closet for 3 months, and they bring in a different formulary of antibiotics. Now, they do this so that you don't develop a lot of resistant organisms in your institution, and they found that this is very effective in preventing resistant organisms. Also important that we feed our patient. Enteral nutrition, very important here. We want to keep up his nutrition so that he has the energy, of course, to fight the bugs. So he has the energy to run the pulmonary musculature, to be able to do the pulmonary hygiene. But also, if we don't use the gut starts to break down. And we get a translocation of bacteria, I should say, from the gut. And that could be causing him to have the pneumonia. Okay, so good pulmonary hygiene. We're going to move him. We're going to keep him hydrated. We're going to give him the antibiotics. And hopefully we're able to feed him as well. All right, let's wrap up by taking a look at our comparison chart on page 7. Notice that it lists the emergency, pulmonary embolism, ARDS, pulmonary edema, pneumothorax, and pneumonia. Then it lists whether or not there is chest pain and what that chest pain is like. Okay, so maybe that'll help to be able to differentiate the problem. Next, we can take a look at the patient's oxygenation and the patient's CO2. In many cases, like pulmonary embolism, ARDS, some of these other cases, you're going to find that the oxygen is low. The patient's hypoxic, but his CO2 is low, indicating that he is blowing off his CO2. So he's not hypercapnic. Of course, the exception to the rule there is going to be pulmonary edema and pneumonia. But oftentimes, like with pulmonary embolism, ARDS, and pneumothorax, the patient remains able to blow off CO2. So if you have a blood gas, that might be a little bit of a clue. If you have difficulty with blood gases, you got to check out our 6 Easy Steps to ABG Analysis program. Simply the easiest program. Absolutely makes it wonderful and easy to be able to learn how to do ABGs. Okay, the next column over is breath sounds. Nonspecific and pulmonary embolism. Remember again, that's going to form over time. We're going to hear rouse eventually, but we don't hear them right away when your patient's having trouble. Diffuse rouse in ARDS. They don't form from the base and work their way up like they do in pulmonary edema. Diminished breath sounds in pneumothorax, bronchi. Coarser breath sounds in pneumonia. And you may even hear diminished breath sounds if the patient's got a big infiltrate somewhere. Now here's the important column, signs of doom. What tells you that this guy, we got to do something about this or this guy's in trouble. In pulmonary embolism, it's hypotension. ARDS, it's refractory hypoxemia. You put him on oxygen, he's still hypoxic. Pulmonary edema, it's going to be the development of hypoxemia. When he develops hypoxemia, we probably don't have the time to wait for Lasix to work. We probably have to do something more. Maybe we've got to give him the nitro. Maybe we have to intubate him. Or at least use BiPAP. Pneumothorax, it's going to be shock. As the patient develops respiratory distress from his pneumothorax, he will probably develop hypoxemia. That's not really a sign of doom. We can oxygenate him. We can put in the chest tube. He's still got one good lung working. But when he starts to develop positive pressure on that side, we call that a tension pneumothorax, he will squeeze the mediastinum and develop shock. That's the sign of doom. Pneumonia, again, hypoxia. We don't have enough good lung left to be able to do the perfusion. Each one of our emergency series is going to contain this comparison chart. I hope this helps you to be able to differentiate what's going on with your patient and try and figure out what it is so that maybe we can kick up the specific type of intervention that's going to help our patient the best, or at least be able to communicate our findings better to the physician so we can get the appropriate treatment. Lastly, notice on page 7 our assessment tip. The bases of the lung in the back have the best perfusion. Therefore, to do a focused assessment on our patient, listen to the bases in the back. Okay, now again, I mentioned that maybe you've got that patient developing the pulmonary edema. He's going from the interstitial phase into the alveolar flooding stage. If that is the case, and we want to stay on top of it, listen to the bases in the back. You don't have to be listening all over the front and all over. Rouse are not going to form there. They form in the dependent area, and that's the bases in the back. So that's the area we're going to pay the most attention to because it has the best perfusion as well. So if we lose that area, the patient's not going to oxygenate. I hope this program was helpful to you. You might want to check out the other emergency programs as they come up. I think you're going to find those very helpful, too. We've really tried to make it a nice comparison and contrast kind of a study and giving you practical tips on how you can be able to be aware that the problem is occurring early and be able to ward it off before your patient's in crisis. Thank you for joining me for Pulmonary Emergencies. My name is David Woodruff. Please check out our website at www.edfornurses.com for more products and more information that you can use in your practice. If you'd like to get tips and time savers to help you to stay up to date, check out our website at updatefornurses.com, where we will give you a free newsletter with free updates every Friday and one of our 101 tips and time savers every Monday. Remember, the service is free. We want to help you so that you can provide better nursing care. Thanks again for joining me. Until next time, bye now.